Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Everybody on its rocky coast knows that the Gulf of Maine has had a collapse of its codfish and fishing. Last week, we learned that climate change and warming waters were a big part of the reason why. It's a story playing out all over the world, from tropical coral reefs to Scottish mackerel. The map of ocean life is changing. This hour on Point, from the Gulf of Maine to the whole planet, the global ocean impact of climate change. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen a change in sea life in the waters you know? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Portland, Maine, is Andrew Pershing, lead author of the new study published in the journal Science, Connecting Climate Change to the Gulf's Collapsed Cod Population. He is Chief Scientific Officer for the Gulf of Maine Research Center. Andrew Pershing, welcome to On Point. Great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What happened? We knew there was a collapse, but you've added a new angle of our understanding. Tell us about it.
So, you know, the really interesting thing to me was that, you know, I've been a little bit outside the fisheries world. And as I was watching the news come in on the cod stock, what was so surprising was how, you know, the people who were you know, managing the stock were just really struggling to figure out why it was collapsing, given that they were cutting the fishing quotas at such a really, huge rate.
They kept radically cutting those quotas, and yet the population seemed to just keep falling, and everyone was kind of bewildered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really is the worst thing that you can have in a fishery, where you're really doing your best to try to regulate it. You set the quotas, the fishermen are having to take their cuts, and then you come back and say, you know, man, we should have really cut it further.
Yeah. So your insight is?
So what we found was that, if we look throughout the data coming from the fishery, we really see this signal of temperature. And in particular, we see the signal of this really rapid warming that we've had in the Gulf of Maine.
You're talking about the Gulf of Maine being the most rapidly warming body of ocean water in the world. Is that right?
Yeah, over the last 10 years, and in the study it was 2004 through 2013, but the statistics still hold pretty well for 2006 through 2015, that, you know, that over that period we warmed faster than 99% of the other places in the ocean.
Now, why is that? Is it the Gulf Stream somehow pouring straight into the Gulf of Maine in a new way because of climate change? What's the connection you're making?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we're still, you know, really trying to figure that out. In the paper, we identified the Gulf Stream as an important, link in this chain, and we've seen a northward shift in the Gulf Stream, both in kind of the long-term trend of it moving a little bit further north every year, but then over the last 10 years, it's also moved north in concert with the temperature change that we see in the Gulf of Maine. And what that does is that tends to push a little bit more warm water into the Gulf of Maine, and it also reduces the amount of cold water that we get that comes in from Canada.
How much temperature change in the Gulf?
So over the last 10 years or so, we've had almost a 3.5 degree Fahrenheit increase in the Gulf of Maine.
Wow. That's a lot. What's the impact here? If that's what the cod don't like, why? What does it affect?
Yeah, that's, you know, that we're what we've been able to do looking at the data is to pull out the two patterns that really seem to be going on in cod. And one is that when we have a warm year, every female cod just produces fewer successful young than she would in during cold years.
Mm-hmm.
And then in warm years, the young fish just don't survive as well to become adults, and so they don't enter the fishery at the rate that that we expect them to.
So we've got a genuine collapse. I mean, it's down to something like, what have I read, 4% of what a healthy cod population would be?
Yep, it's 4% of 3 to 4% of what we, you know, what we think it should be based on the kind of the long-term average for this stock. And if you look at Georges Bank, which is just, you know, just to the south of the Gulf of Maine, the calculations there suggest that that stock may even be at 1% of the sustainable levels.
And 1%. And the story here is not limited to the Gulf of Maine. You have stories all over the world of different kinds of ocean life being affected, most affected when you've got a species at the edge of its range. And you describe the Gulf of Maine being at the range edge for cod. What does that mean, Andy?
So, you know, cod are distributed throughout the North Atlantic, but they have, you know, lots of environments where they live, and each of those has a different temperature. And so the Gulf of Maine is really one of the warmest places where you find cod. And so it's not surprising that if that ecosystem warms up, that that's going to be stressful for that population. The flip side are ecosystems like, you know, like the Grand Banks off of Newfoundland or the Barents Sea north of Norway that are the coldest places where you find cod. And in those environments, the warming over the last few years has really helped boost those populations, including it looks like fueling a recovery of cod off of Newfoundland.
So I'm trying to figure, is this genuinely something like a die-off or more simply a migration? I mean, they're in the ocean. They can swim. They don't like the temperature. They go to where it's cooler. They go someplace else.
Yeah, so, you know, my colleagues have really looked into that, and, you know, that's a hard one to do. We don't track the fish. We don't have tags on them the way that we can with, you know, with some other animals. But it doesn't look like we've seen a shift of them, you know, like they're steadily marching to the north and east. It really, if anything, looks like the distribution of cod has actually shifted to the west towards the coast, so along the coast of Massachusetts and New Hampshire. And what's interesting to me is that that's, you know, that's their some of their preferred habitat, but it's also some of the coldest water that we have in the Gulf of Maine. So it looks in some ways like they might be climbing up, if you will, you know, a mountain, just like, you know, species on land will do when you warm things up.
Andy Pershing, stand by. There's a lot more we want to learn there in the Gulf of Maine and globally. I want to get a real hands-on feeling here of the fisherman life and how it looks from the Maine perspective. Bill Trotter's with us, reporter for the Bangor Daily News. He's been writing about fisheries in the Gulf of Maine for a long, long time. Bill Trotter, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here, Bill.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
I guess the fishermen already knew this was going on. I suppose the hammer's already come down on them between quotas and just the absence of cod. What's the effect when you go down to the wharfs in Maine? What has it been in recent years?
Well, fishermen were already aware that cod stocks or cod catches were declining, and they have been since the 1990s. That's when catches peaked in Maine and other places up in Atlantic Canada, and catches have been declining steadily since then. The introduction of warming water temperatures is kind of a new element here that people are grappling with and trying to come to terms with. In terms of fishing in Maine, largely what has taken the place of cod in terms of what's being brought ashore by the fishermen is lobster. Lobster landings have shot up through the roof since the early 1990s as stocks of cod and other groundfish species in the Gulf of Maine have declined. And many people are concerned that fishermen along the coast are becoming overly dependent on lobster, and if should something happen to that particular species, where would they turn to? This created a lot of – they're doing well for the moment with the abundance and the price of lobster, but if something should happen to that, they're not sure what would take its place.
Now, Bill, describe what goes on underwater here for people who don't know between cod and lobster and why that might have a direct impact on lobster population if cod is virtually disappeared.
Well, a lot of people have suggested, scientists and industry officials, that one of the reasons that lobsters have grown in population in the Gulf is because of the predation has disappeared or declined greatly with the decline of cod.
I mean, the cod would feast on lobster, and now they're not there to do it.
Exactly right. And there's that held the population in check for a long time, and without that predation occurring, there's nothing to keep the lobster population from booming, which is what has happened over the past 25 years.
Is it possible that the lobsters enjoy the temperature increase, or are they less vulnerable because they can somehow move around to stay away from it?
Well, some scientists say that the warming temperature has actually benefited lobsters a little bit in the Gulf of Maine, that it's made the survival easier for younger lobsters.
Mm-hmm.
But warm water is not necessarily great for lobsters. I mean, just look what's happened south of Cape Cod and along the Atlantic coast down there, Long Island Sound, Rhode Island, and the southern coast of Massachusetts. The population down there and the landings down there that fishermen have caught has dropped off tremendously.
And what about the rest of what you follow there, Bill? Scallops, I don't know, shrimp, sea urchins?
Well, it's a lot of it has changed over the years. Shrimp, for example, are much like cod. There's been no fishery for shrimp in the Gulf of Maine. And we're talking about the smaller shrimp here, not the larger kind that you would find down in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But the smaller kind, called northern shrimp, there's been no fishery for that because they seem to have largely disappeared from the Gulf of Maine as well. Sea urchins, their population has dropped off. There's a lot of indication that that's because of overfishing back in the 1990s. There's probably a correlation there with water temperature as well. But other species have gone up in the Gulf, not just lobster.
How does it feel, Bill, to have your temperatures there in the Gulf of Maine rising faster than temperatures in 99.9% of the global ocean? It's almost as though the fickle finger of fate has landed right on you in a hot, bad way.
Well, it's definitely created a lot of concern along the coast and fishing communities. 2012 was really an eye-opener year for a lot of fishermen here because that year in particular was very warm compared to prior years. And it upset the natural cycles for lobster and the catch patterns that fishermen were used to. They caught a lot of lobster in the spring, and there was a glut of available lobster and not a lot of place to sell it, so the price went down tremendously. And that occurred again somewhat in 2013. Last year, 2014, the water went back to being colder than it had than the prior 2 years, and the normal fishing patterns returned, and the price went up, which also helped the fishermen. But there's no doubt if the water increases again, it's going to catch people by surprise and upset a lot of patterns that people are used to.
So what do you think fishermen are thinking there? We're going to look globally, but off the coast of Maine, adapt or long-term get out of fishing? Climate change makes it too unpredictable.
Well, I don't know that anybody wants to get out of fishing. A lot of people do it because they've been in it for generations in their families.
Mm-hmm.
They enjoy it a great deal. And if you fish for lobster, now is a great time to be a fisherman here in the state of Maine. The catch sizes have increased sixfold in the past 25 years.
Wow.
The price has been up above $4 for much of this year, which is a fairly high price. So lobstermen are doing fairly well. And they want to ride that as long as they can. If the lobster catch goes back down, they might turn their attention to another kind of species.
Waves of change under the sea. Bill Trotter covers them for the Bangor Daily News. Bill, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our oceans, climate change, and the cod fisheries collapse in the Gulf of Maine. What it tells us about the rest of the seas and what's going on out there. Fish moving out, moving on, the tropics in trouble. Andrew Pershing is with us from the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. A chief scientific officer there joins us today from Portland, Maine. We're going to look right on around the planet. You can join us. What do you think as we change the climate, change the temperature? What do you expect from sea life, the fish? If you were a fish, would you stick around if things got hot? And fishermen, Mainers and beyond, do you see fish populations changing, shifting, thinning out, moving on? Are you finding kinds of fish, sea life, in your patch that you wouldn't have found before? Is cod the canary in the coal mine here, abandoning the Gulf of Maine? Lobster are great, but it's caused a lot of fishermen headaches over the year for cod and cod quotas to be way down. Last year, Gulf of Maine fisherman David Osher spoke out against cod fishing restrictions to a local NBC affiliate, WCSH.
It just doesn't seem to be helping, everything they've done. There's something else going on that they're missing, and we're the easiest target to blame it on. They're just starving us to death, a slow death. Why don't they just close the whole Gulf of Maine down and subsidize us like they do the wind farmers and the solar energy companies and the farmers out west? They pay them not to farm, so why don't they pay us not to fish?
The fishermen's lament there on the Gulf of Maine, and yes, indeed, there's something else going on. Andrew Pershing's outfit says it's warming temperatures in that water. It's climate change at work, and it's not just off the northeast coast of the United States. By any means, look around the globe. Here's a little sound. In January of this year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation reporting on scientists in Australia trying to understand how climate change would affect different marine animals. You heard a reporter here, Richard Baines, then scientist Greta Peel.
Scientists in Tasmania have developed a system to determine how different marine animals respond to climate change. In southeastern Australia, the system found abalone and rock lobster were the most sensitive.
And then we also have a suite of species like snapper and yellowtail kingfish that look like they will be shifting further south and increasing in abundance.
Species on the move all over the world. Andy Pershing, please stand by in Portland, Maine. From Santa Barbara, California, Ben Halpern joins us right now, marine biologist at the Marine Science Institute at the University of California, Santa Barbara, author of the study in Nature, Climate Change, Climate Velocity in the Future, Global Redistribution of Marine Biodiversity. Ben Halpern, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Can you kind of paint an undersea map of the world in terms of trends in ocean life related to sea temperature change, climate change?
Yeah, that's right. We use the movement in temperature as it's predicted into the future and sort of how species will track those changes in temperature to see how marine life will reshuffle itself as it moves into the future. And we look at different climate scenarios, and it's a pretty stark difference in sort of the business as usual climate change to 2100. And if we take more sort of dramatic efforts to mitigate climate change, and we can really change how species are going to redistribute across the planet.
Got Paris coming up with a lot of talk about addressing climate change. Just to drive home the significance of that, let's say we, I don't know what kind of vectors you've plotted, but let's say we stay on the kind of vector we've been on of increasing global temperature and ocean temperature. How would that play out?
Yeah, and I mean, if we don't make big changes, that's where we're going to be. And we see pretty dramatic shifts, especially in the tropics, in places like the Coral Triangle, which is Indonesia, Philippines, Papua New Guinea area, which is sort of the heart of biodiversity of marine life. It's the richest, most specious place on the planet in marine systems, and in the Arctic. So these are two places I think that people are paying a lot of attention to, coral reefs and Arctic. And in both cases, we're going to see a lot of species disappear. And in the Arctic, actually, a whole bunch of new species show up that is just going to change the face of the Arctic. It's not going to be a place we recognize like it is today.
Is it about actual disappearance, as in, I don't know, extinction or local disappearance, or is it about migration? I mean, we hear about some cod going away, but also a lot of cod just moving.
It's going to be both. So they're like the warmer water species in the tropics, they might be able to move towards the poles and if they can keep up with the changing climate. But the species that are at the poles, like in the Arctic, it's like a mountaintop. They'll eventually get pushed off. There's nowhere for them to go. They can't jump off the planet onto a new planet. They're stuck up there. So you will see some extinctions. You'll also see a lot of species moving. And that's why we kind of talk about it as a reshuffling of biodiversity. It's a whole bunch of species in new places that used to not be there and interacting with other species they've never encountered before. And there's a lot of uncertainty what that's going to mean for marine life on the planet.
Some marine life can move more easily than the human beings who have settled around fisheries. I mean, where do you see human populations taking the biggest hit because of sea life changes?
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of our cultures and communities have fixed in place on the species that they've fished, just like we're hearing about in the Gulf of Maine. And no one really wants to pick up their whole community and move 100 miles up the coast just to stay with the fish. So some of the developing countries in the tropics that are on islands, they don't have anywhere to go. And if their fish and fisheries disappear, they're stuck. They don't have a whole lot of options. You know, in the Gulf of Maine, maybe fishermen can shift to a different species as something moves in, but that's hard. You have to change your gear, you change your boats, change your institutions and regulations. So human communities often adapt less quickly than marine life is able to do in a lot of cases.
And it sounds like tropical islanders may be among some of the worst hit. I mean, they can't just move this way or that. Their island is where it is.
Yeah, that's right. And if the coral reefs that support the fisheries are also being impacted by bleaching and ocean acidification, then not only are the fisheries gone, but also the reefs that provide protection to their shores and keep away storm waves. So those countries are facing quite a lot of problems as it comes to climate change.
Ben Halpern in Santa Barbara, California. Stand by. And Andy Pershing in Portland, Maine. Brian's calling from Montreal in Canada. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to throw in the human part of the mix, along with all your experts in marine life.
Mm-hmm.
We've just had 2 weeks ago a federal election here that in the maritime provinces of eastern Canada seems to have been affected by these changes in the way sea life is living in the warming waters.
Wait, your election has been affected by warming waters in the ocean to help us out? What do you mean?
I'll cut to the chase.
Yeah.
The Federal Conservative Party, which is modeled on mainstream Republican policies in the U.S., okay. had a long historic connection to the Maritimes, and some of their most important ministers, the people who were helping develop their policies over the last 10, 12 years of government, had sat there. Now, some of the real old hands who were those old graybeards, they actually decided not to run again, probably because they couldn't see themselves winning. And the ones who didn't quit were every last one of them defeated in the election here in those maritime provinces.
So what, these are climate change politics because humans are having a hard time living with the policies that they've pursued?
Well, bear with me. The government of a Republican style here in Canada would want to cut back on some of the infrastructure, which gives us high tax rates. That usually would make people happy. But among the things they cut back was local control of emergency response, Coast Guard type operation okay. that used to be run locally by people who knew the local waters and the local weather conditions. By rationalizing that and using modern technology, they moved it thousands of miles away to where there were larger populations to to work with, and on and on it goes.
Yeah.
But as a consequence, the fishing fleets, which have had to move way up north into the Davis Strait, way up between Canada and Greenland, they were more and more isolated from any emergency services they might get. And as a consequence, one famous case, one fish boat just got into trouble. It was getting swamped way up in a way Arctic storm up near Baffin Island, and there was no Canadian resources within 2 days' commute of them. They had to call in a helicopter from Greenland run by the Danes. That got a lot of press, and as a consequence, I'm saying to you, a big chunk of the population who aren't just in the fishing industry said, this government doesn't understand our world. They don't understand the way we've been living for 400 years. We're going to vote for change, and not a single conservative got reelected.
Brian, I appreciate your call. I mean, Andy Pershing, there's a story. It's not just the marine life environment that has changed when ocean temperatures change. We humans are part of this natural picture as well, affecting it in a huge way. But, I mean, you know, you've got cod on the move, you've got humans on the move at the same time, and there even human politics come right into the picture, as Brian describes it out of Montreal, Andy.
Yeah, I think it's what's really interesting to me as you think about climate change is that, you know, this is something that scientists have been, you know, have been seeing in data now for, you know, with a pretty clear signal now for 10, 15, 20 years. But, you know, I think it's really only now that people are starting to really feel the impact of climate change in their daily life. And I think that, you know, that has a potential to have a really transformative impact on, you know, on the politics around climate change.
We'll see how much impact it has on climate policy. Paris coming right up. Peter in Boston. Peter, thank you for calling. You're on.
Yeah, hi. I work for a tuna fishing and manufacturing company. We actually own and operate the largest fleet in the eastern tropical Pacific and based out of Colombia and Ecuador. And we are sole tuna operators. The tuna seiners that we have are, as you know, six of that species. And we're noticing a big change, too. When I went out as a young, after college, instead of working for a bank, I went to fish.
Yeah.
And we caught up 1,500 ton in 3 weeks. This is the norm, even though the vessels were provisioned for 60 to 80 days.
Okay.
Our ships now are coming out 100 days, not full. We're going out from the American coastline out to 145 degrees west, up to the Marquesas, Polynesia. I mean, vast territories. We've been lucky with the cost of fuel coming down. Our biggest import cost is less, so, you know, we're able to maintain margin. But it's become very, very difficult. And I think one of the things that's odd about this is how disconnected the people are, the consumers, from the actual operation. In our case, you look at that can of tuna that's in every store in the world.
Yeah.
It's cheap. And you think about all the effort coming into this to produce that. You know, how does this last? And what is a company like ours supposed to do when we have gear fixed to this? You know, how do you retool? And then you don't count the thousands of people we employ in the canneries. And maybe the answer to this is, frankly, a full-blown effort to aquaculture and local production, as described in that book, The Perfect Protein, that was written or ghostwritten by the CEO of Oceana. In any case, I just want to ask your panelists, what do they think about that? You know, switching out of the industry or moving to the industry? Because in our case, we're not going to be able to control the climate. We're not going to be able to control the surface temperatures in the Eastern Pacific. Hey,
Peter, and, may I ask you, because your family's in the business, I mean, one of the biggest in the Pacific tuna.
I work for a family business.
Yeah. All right, yeah. Do you sometimes feel like you shouldn't be doing it at all? Like if the
yes.
if you
oh yes oh sure yes I feel very guilty. I mean, I remember we'd come out, you know, people asked me, let's go fishing for the afternoon. I said, you know, when I was 23 years old on the back of a tuna stand on the deck, you know, I caught more fish in one day than, you know, the most fish will catch in 5,000 lifetimes.
Yeah,
and yeah, I feel very guilty about it. I do know, however, this is the most perfect protein. It is a perfect food, and I think it's just incredibly mismanaged. In our case, you know, we have the Inter-American Tropical Tuna Commission regulating this stuff, but it's frankly the wolf is guarding the hen house, and you know, we're in the maw of this thing. We're the enemies of Greenpeace, but frankly, you know, we are concerned about this. But you know, there's so much duplicity and I think frankly corruption in this world.
Peter, we've got it, the report right from the deck of the tuna boat practically there, and I'm really happy for that call. I mean, Ben Halpern, how about it? You say we need to change climate policy in the hope of turning this around, but when you've got that kind of urgency, those boats now going out all the way to Polynesia to find the tuna that they used to find abundant, and you've got the fisherman right there saying he thinks maybe we just need to get out of that and into aquaculture and lay off the seas. What about harvesting policies in this century when we're trying to put the brakes on climate change?
Yeah, the caller brings up a whole set of issues about what the species in the ocean are facing. So certainly climate change is a big one, but there's lots of other things that we are doing to species in the oceans. Fishing, overfishing is certainly an example, but there's pollution and all sorts of other impacts that we have on these species. And climate change is a harder ship to redirect. There's a lot of inertia in the in the climate change right now, whereas fishing policies are something that we can change certainly from year to year in theory, although tuna politics are a different beast. So it's a bit...
Because they're so wide-ranging, you mean, the tuna.
That's right. The tunas, they migrate across entire oceans and they're harvested by lots of different countries and they're so valuable, there's huge pressure to keep harvesting them. So I'm not saying that's an easy fix, but that's certainly a way to address tuna problems faster than trying to deal with climate change. But I think it points to the need to address the threats to marine species as a multi-pronged issue. It's definitely climate change is a big part of it, but overfishing and pollution can play equal or larger roles in some places for sure.
Andy Pershing in Portland, Maine, what have you found in the reaction to your study out in Science getting lots of attention here? I mean, do humans take this on board naturally, or do they just resist the whole idea of a fundamental change in the ocean environment caused by climate change? You know, do we have so much entropy built in, we just keep on the path we're on? Do you see people appearing eager to change somehow in response, or do we just keep, you know, doing our thing?
I think that's it's a really great question, and it's been really fascinating for me to see, you know, to see the reaction to this paper. And, you know, our reason for writing it was to really try to start some of these conversations. And, you know, I think we've gotten a really good response from the, you know, from the fishery management community, who recognize that, you know, their job is just much, much harder if they're not including the information that, you know, on the processes that are really driving the stocks that they're trying to manage. So I'm optimistic that we can, you know, that we can begin to, to improve things for our management, both here in New England and I think around the world, because, you know, our cod story is certainly localized to us, but, you know, this is something that, you know, that fisheries all over the world are going to be encountering as we see ecosystems move beyond their historical norms.
What would it take to bring it back in the Gulf of Maine, the cod population? Or is that now beyond has climate change put that out of reach?
No. So we actually did calculations in our paper where we project some different levels of warming and look at what the cod population could be. And our calculation suggests that we could rebuild the fishery to the point where we actually have a fishery in the Gulf of Maine, but it would be much smaller than the one that we've been envisioning, maybe half or even a third, depending on the amount of warming that we get. But in the meantime, it means that we have to be very careful with how we manage this stock. And I think that the Management Council has done a good job at really pulling back on the quotas to the point where there really is you know, fishermen are now avoiding cod and trying to catch other species.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about our oceans, climate change, the cod fisheries collapse in the Gulf of Maine, and what it tells us about the rest of the seas, what's going on out there, fish moving out, moving on, the tropics in trouble, all kinds of issues. Here at last month, CBS News reporter Jeff Glore reported on coral reef bleaching. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says 5% of the world's coral could be lost this year. You'll hear Glore first, then NOAA scientist Mark Egan.
Bleaching occurs when coral is exposed to warmer than normal water. The coral gets stressed and loses its coat of protection. If the coral remains exposed for long periods of time, it can die. NOAA says climate change is the primary cause.
2014 was the warmest year on record, so coming into this year, the oceans were already warm.
And of course, it's just not warming the seas. Lots of man-made impacts. Here's a 2013 story from the Seattle Times. Reporter Craig Welch talks about oyster farming with oyster farmer Kathleen Nisbet about how ocean acidification due to CO2 has killed off many of her oysters.
Kathleen's family business nearly dissolved beneath her feet. The seawater that once nourished their oysters, both on the mudflats and in hatcheries where they buy their oyster larvae, instead had started to kill them. The reason? Rising CO2 emissions from our cars and power plants is changing the chemistry of the sea. This phenomenon, known as ocean acidification, was always expected to hit shelled creatures hard, but that wasn't supposed to happen until late in the century. Instead, it's happening now.
We've got warming, we've got acidification, human fingerprints all over the oceans. You can join us. Are we prepared to act or to live with the consequences if we don't in pushing back on these trends? And what are you seeing in coral, in the tropics, in the waters you know best when it comes to climate change? Ben, we've got lots of questions here online. Neil asks or says, eventually lobster and all shellfish and coral will not be able to form their shells because of the increased acidity. What do you say, Ben?
Globally, I don't know if that's quite true, but certainly in places, the acidification will get to be too much for most shelled creatures to be able to adapt. It's just they can't grow the shell fast enough to keep up with the dissolving action of the ocean acidification. But there'll be places, bays, seas, where maybe the ocean acidification isn't quite as strong, and there probably will be some species that are able to adapt. But in the big picture, ocean acidification is sort of this lurking monster of a threat to marine biodiversity.
And Andy Pershing, another observation from a listener here, colder water holds more oxygen, colder water holds more nutrients. True, Andy? And what does warming mean in that framework?
Yeah, it's generally true. I mean, especially the oxygen one, and that's one of the things that we've thought a little bit about in cod, and that if you have warmer water, you have less oxygen, and it just speeds up the metabolism of the fish, so they just need more food even to just stay in place, right, let alone thinking about how they're going to invest into growth or reproduction.
Let's go to Jeff in Madison, Wisconsin. Jeff, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I am in Madison, but I grew up on the coast of Maine, and I think it's not just the cod. You talked about a canary in the coal mine. I believe I read somewhere that mollusks may well be, and I can tell you in the past, I myself would regularly go down to collect mussels off the rocks, and it would take me, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it would take me about 10, maybe 15 minutes to fill up a big soup pot. You'd find them in clumps of 10, 15, 20 under the seaweed.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved away, so it's been a while since I did this. This past year, I went back for a family reunion. There were six of us on those same rocks. It took us over 2.5 hours to fill up that same soup pot. You would find one, possibly two, in a crevice moving great sheaths of seaweed aside.
Yeah.
They just aren't there. They weren't there. So, I feel for the fishermen. I have friends who are doing it, but I'd really encourage scientists to take a hard look as well at what's happening to the other life on the coast there.
Jeff, I appreciate your call. I mean, it's just so sad to hear that description coming back for a family reunion. Andy, what do you make of that on the mussels, the mollusk front?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one. We've heard that from a few people, that it really was started last year, where there was an observation that there were very few baby mussels settling along the rocks along the coast of Maine and really throughout northern New England last year. And so those are the going to be the larger mussels that you might find, you know, to put in your pot this year. So that's not unexpected. This year it does seem like there's been a really good set of new baby mussels. But boy, I've not heard a good explanation for why it was low last year and why it was, you know, why it was better this year.
Brooks in Newton, Massachusetts. Brooks, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I was just wondering if the panelists had any thoughts on the potential. Excuse me, I think it was on speakerphone. On the potential of the Gulf Stream perhaps shutting down when the glaciers in the Arctic melt and the fresh water flows into the North Atlantic. Is that an idea that's still thought to be like possible, or?
Yeah, we used to hear a lot about that. Andy, you described the Gulf Stream as maybe being key to this warming of the Gulf of Maine. I mean, the shutting down of the Gulf Stream has been described as kind of apocalyptic, but is it still looming out there as a possibility that would recold things?
Yeah, there was that movie, right? I think it was The Day After Tomorrow that came out that sort of, you know, it was a fictionalized account of a catastrophic collapse of the Atlantic, what we call the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. That kind of catastrophic case doesn't seem to be out there, and there's been a lot of climate modeling work that's dismissed that you know, really catastrophic shutdown. But it definitely seems like part of our climate future in the Atlantic is a slowdown of the AMOC, the meridional overturning circulation. And that goes hand in hand with the northward shift in the Gulf Stream in our region, but then you get less heat transported into the northern part of the Atlantic. And so scientists think that we may be seeing a little bit of that this year. There's a patch in the North Atlantic south of Greenland that's a little bit colder than normal, and they actually attribute that to a slowdown in the AMOC.
Ben, what would it take to throw the brakes on? Leave acidification aside for a moment, though maybe the CO2 has a lot to do with that as well. But to get us off of this path, we're going to be – everybody's meeting in Paris, I guess, in December. But how big a change in the way people live to turn this around and not have just an empty soup pot in the ocean?
Well, that's the million-dollar question on how much we can get people to change. I think how much we need to get people to change, it's both dramatic but also doable, in the sense that, you know, if we shifted away from fuel-based cars and more into hybrid or electric cars, if people ate a lot less meat, because cow production is one of the biggest producers of greenhouse gases, if we, you know, took a lot of these steps to decrease our personal footprint, which often needs to be motivated by government kind of rules and regulations to make people act that way. We can turn it around for sure, but it's not going to be just shifting from garbage to recycling. We have to do, you know, bigger actions than that to really make the difference.
I want to really look at the Pacific for a moment here. Nicholas Bond joins us from Seattle, research meteorologist at the NOAA's Cooperative Institute at the University of Washington. Nicholas Bond, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hello.
You've been following what's been called the blob in the Pacific and El Nino. What's going on, Nicholas?
Yeah, for the last year or two, we've had much warmer than normal upper ocean temperatures in the Northeast Pacific, and we've seen impacts for the entire food chain from plankton to fish and top predators.
Is this something permanent or something temporary? Is it climate change related?
It looks like it's just a kind of a short-term episode of the climate variability, but a lot of us are thinking it's kind of a dress rehearsal, at least in some ways, for climate change.
In this so-called blob, these warmer waters, do you see the kind of temperature increase that they saw in the Gulf of Maine? I've been reading about 4 degrees Fahrenheit higher than average there. And what about the nutrient content of those warmer waters?
Yeah, that's right. Well, at places, it's been as much as 6 or 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal at various spots and at times. It's kind of a dynamic system, not static. And so it's been rather extreme, in some places, unprecedented warm temperatures. Like you said, that has impacted nutrient concentrations, and in particular, it's impacted the kind of The species that are there on the in the West Coast, there are some kind of cold water species, and then there are ones more adapted to warm water, and we've seen the warm conditions favoring those warm water species.
Those are high temperatures. How do they interact with algae and the algae blooms? We've seen reports out of what, Washington, Oregon, California?
Yeah, and that's something that's really serious. The harmful algal blooms that have been seen along the West Coast from Monterey Bay all the way up into the Gulf of Alaska have been kind of unprecedented. Again, I'll keep using that word, in both geographic scope and in the duration. They started in the spring and kind of in some places have lasted through the entire summer.
And Nicholas, we hear also about this, what they call, I don't know how to pronounce it even, the Pacific, is it decadal oscillation? Big decade or more long changes in temperature that go up and down, may have been down, in fact, in spite of this heating, maybe headed up, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When this whole heating event started up, that so-called Pacific Decadal Oscillation was in its negative or cool phase. It has switched around and is now strongly positive. And we've seen before that has real implications for the ecosystem, and it definitely is this time also.
So could that have been the thing that paused some of the global temperature rise in some areas? Might that speed global temperature rise now that it's turning around, that oscillation?
Yeah, that's exactly right. That it seems like, to a certain extent, when the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is in its negative phase, that the oceans at depth soak up a lot of the extra heat coming out of the atmosphere. And now that it's going into the positive phase, the waters are warmer near the surface, and it is liable to contribute to a little bit warmer climate. The El Nino that's going on right now does some of the same sorts of things.
Mass coral bleaching in Hawaii last year. This is not just far, far away. Tom in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Tom, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Just a note about how complex and unstable the system can be. There are chain reactions, and one of them happened in December 2012 when a bird called Razorbill, which rarely goes south in the winter of New York or New Jersey, went for the first time in a number of thousands down toward Florida. This is a seabird, and even some of them went around to Louisiana for the first time in the history. We've been watching this bird for a couple hundred years. It never did this before. It depends on fish. It depends upon water temperature. It breeds in the Gulf of Maine and Newfoundland, and it was doing freaky things back in 2012, and Andy Pershing knows all about it.
What? Because they're following the fish. Andy, what about the razorbill? What have you seen?
Well, I haven't studied the razorbill in particular, but I have heard the talk that Tom talks about. One of the things that I think has been really fascinating in the Gulf of Maine is that as you know, as we've warmed up, and the warming that we have is really shared with the whole Northwest Atlantic, so the Gulf of St. Lawrence, Labrador Sea, you know, Baffin Bay, and some of these very kind of near Arctic areas. And one of the things that we've noticed is as this system warms up, often some of the Arctic animals, we actually find them doing funny things like coming south. So in the last few years in the Gulf of Maine, we've had sightings of bowhead whales, which are normally an Arctic species. We've had harp seals here fairly regularly in the Gulf of Maine. And this is, you know, way south of where they should
be. Why wouldn't they cluster even further north to stay in the cold temperatures they know?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it's just a sign at how, you know, the environment is I think, very confusing for a lot of these animals. The cues that they expect to get are not there. And when they don't get those cues, they sort of go off their program. And, you know, you can find them in funny places.
Ben Halpern, give us a couple more examples here. Scottish mackerel, Australian urchins. Tell us the stories.
Yeah, there's stories all over the place, but the Scottish mackerel, it's a huge fishery for Scotland and kind of fueled their economy in a lot of ways, and it's starting to shift north and west a little bit, and now that it's being fished in Iceland, and it's kind of brewing some fishery wars, much like the cod wars in the past. So you can get this these shifts in species creating winners and losers. The Icelandic people are quite happy to have the fish move in there, whereas the Scottish people aren't so happy that they're losing control of their fishery. So it's a real challenge in this whole movement of species is that you know, some people are happy that it's happening because they're getting new things and other people are losing things. Although I'd say in the end, I think we're probably all going to end up losing because the reshuffling of marine life is just mixing things up too much.
Let's try and turn it around. Australian urchins and kelp forests down there between Australia, Tasmania, movement there as well.
That's right. So, yeah, the urchins that are further north in that case are moving south into Tasmania, and urchins graze on the kelp forests, and kelp forests are kind of a foundation species that create a whole ecosystem. Lots of species are dependent on that. It's a combination of overfishing the lobsters there that helped keep the urchins in check, but the urchins are now grazing down the kelp forest and seeing a pretty dramatic shift in the whole ecosystem there. And this story is playing out over and over again. There's copepods, the little zooplankton base of the food chain, are shifting in the North Sea around Great Britain to smaller, warmer water species. And these things are like delicious and nutritious for marine life. And when you reduce the amount of them there and the nutrient content of them there, it has this cascading effect on marine life, which then feeds back into fisheries and all the things that people care about. So it's just, there's a lot of things going on all over the planet.
Nicholas Bond in Seattle, you're our research meteorologist here. We had meteorologists speaking up for some time saying they didn't buy climate change. Now it sounds so precipitous that where we stand in regard to oceans and a lot more. I mean, you named the blob that pattern out in the Pacific. How do you look at climate change and where do you look for hope here, Nicholas?
It's certainly happening, and it's not linear changes, and there's always kind of counterexamples and that sort of thing, but the evidence is just overwhelming. It is happening, and we just have to kind of figure out both how to adapt to it and mitigate it. And I think both Andrew and Ben were talking about, we can take steps to minimize the changes. Some of them are kind of built into the system. We've put enough CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Some warming, additional warming, is inevitable. But how fast it warms and the final place we get to, that's up to us.
Listeners, when you hear debates about environmental policy, keep all of the information of this hour squarely in mind. Nicholas Bond at the University of Washington, NOAA's Cooperative Institute there. Thank you for joining us, Nick.
Thank you.
Andy Pershing at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And Ben Halpern in Santa Barbara. Thanks for joining us, Ben. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.